You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is a special presentation from a public reading and discussion at the Tube Factory Art Space featuring Tamara Winfrey Harris and her book, Dear Black Girl, Letters from Sisters and Stepping Into Your Power. Tamara Winfrey Harris is the best-selling author of The Sisters Are Alright, winner of the Phyllis Wheatley Award, Indie Fab Award, and more. Winfrey Harris has been published in a multitude of media outlets, including The New York Times, The Atlantic, and New York Magazine.
Welcome, welcome, everybody. I am so excited to be in this space. I just wanted to remind everyone, if you haven't been back to see the wonderful exhibit, to please do so before you leave. I am Tamara Winfrey Harris, and I am the author of Dear Black Girl, Letters to Your Sisters on Stepping Into Your Power, and also The Sisters Are All Right, Changing the Broken Narrative of Black Women in America. I am a writer who specializes in the intersection of race and gender, and I've been published in several places like the New York Times, in the Atlantic, and Ebony. I'm also, along with Dr. Carolyn Strong, a co-founder of Centering Sisters, which centers the experiences of Black women and Black girls. And I thank you for joining me here today. I am excited to have Dr. Carolyn Strong with me. I love this thing that someone said about her. She is a cultural light bringer with plenty of shade, and that is true. She is an educator. She is an expert on intraracial bullying. She is the author of the Equity Learning Syllabus for the state of Illinois. She is a champion of Black women and girls. She is, along with me, the co-founder of Centering Sisters, and she is a contributor to Dear Black Girl. She also mixes great drinks, but that's neither here nor there. Thank you.
Always here.
Thank you, Dr. Carolyn Strong.
Thank you.
So, since we have sort of a smaller, intimate group here, I'd really love to know who you are so we can have a real dialogue.
That would be awesome, because normally the groups do not lend themselves to this amount of intimacy. So, it's always fun to be able to take advantage of that.
So, would you mind if we go around the room, maybe start right there, and give us your name? And really quickly, what made you come here today? Shatay and LaShonda, both of you, thank you for creating this space for us to have this conversation. And so what we're going to do for the next hour or so is we're going to share some letters from Dear Black Girl, possibly also some readings from The Sisters Are All Right. And Carolyn and I are going to be in dialogue about Black women and girls' experiences. But this is not just a dialogue between the two of us. I truly want this to be a dialogue with everyone in this space. So again, please be open and honest and compassionate is all that I ask. And I want you to know that every voice that comes in this room is welcome, but Black women and Black girls' voices are prioritized because we will be talking about our actual lived experiences. And so please listen. All right, good. So I thought first what I might do to create some context is read the preface from The Sisters Are All Right and then the preface from Dear Black Girl, which I think creates kind of a context for the conversation that we're having. So first, from The Sisters Are All Right, which I wrote in 2015 and the second edition came out in fall of last year. I love Black women. I love the Baptist church mothers in white. I love the girls who bus it on TikTok. I love the sisters with the Ivy League degrees and the ones with GEDs. I love the big mamas, madears, and aunties. I love the lock-wearing sisters who smell like shea butter. I love the ladies of the Divine Nine. I love the hot girls in Savage Fenty, designer pumps, and premium lace fronts, and the girls who keep a fresh Caesar. I love the girls who jumped double dutch and played hopscotch. I love the Nam-myoho Renge Kyo chanters, the hoodoos, and the atheists. I love the hustlers, scratching and surviving, trying to make a way out of no way. I love the trans sisters living out loud. I love the awkward Black girls and the quirky Black girls and the Black girls who listen to punk. I love the standing on a bus stop, sucking on a lollipop, round the way girls. I love Black women. I love us in every way we show up in the world. Black women have claimed and asserted our power, laying new ground for collective liberation since I wrote the first edition of this book. Like we always do, it ignites my spirit. We have our first biracial Black woman as Vice President of the United States, and the first openly transgender Black woman serving in the Minneapolis City Council. There are three Black women leading the modern civil rights movement. Black women were the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs, at least until COVID-19 upended the whole world. Beyonce has broken the internet 51 times. And Bill O'Reilly, who used to have so much to say about her, fired from Fox News in 2017. Now, O'Reilly's dismissal had nothing to do with B. I just wanted to provide a moment of schadenfreude, or in Black girl speak, you hate to see it. Black women have come a long way. We are still not free, though. Black women organizers routinely put their lives on the line to protest violence against other bodies, while brutality against ours provokes shamefully little passion. Black women with privileges such as class and education and light skin have far better access to power and achievement, insulation from racism and misogyny sold separately. Too many of us are poor. Too many of us don't have health care. Too many of us are or have been incarcerated. Too many of us are struggling to gain a post-secondary education or are buried under college debt. Too many of us have been assaulted. Too many of us are carrying the weight of other people's problems. The sisters are still all right, intrinsically valuable and human, and we are still struggling. I've studied yoga for years and recently completed a 200-hour yoga teacher training. And on my mat, I've found spiritual tools to navigate life as a Black woman. I also found, in a popular mantra, Sanskrit words to describe what liberation might feel like for me and my sisters. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. May all things, may all beings be happy, healthy, safe, and free. That sort of liberation is hard to find because the world does not love Black women. Not in the way we deserve to be loved. It doesn't truly see us. Our authentic collective and individual selves are usually hidden by racist and sexist stereotypes that we can't seem to shake, or rather images that other folks won't let us shake. This is confirmed for me every time I read yet another article about a little Black girl sent home from school, not for bad behavior or bad grades, but for having kinky hair. Every time some well-meaning pundit or preacher offers advice to fix Black women to be more marriageable. Every time some hack comedian tells a specious joke about tyrannical Black wives and girlfriends. Every time Snoop Dogg, that is, I once walked two bare-breasted Black women on leashes down a red carpet and ran an actual brothel, Snoop Dogg, tut-tuts at Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion for singing about their own wet-ass pussy. Every time a young Black woman is shot dead by police in the night, every time the American healthcare system mishandles Black women's lives, leaving dead mothers and dead babies and dead Black women doctors who allegedly too intimidated healthcare professionals to receive adequate care, which we all know happened right here in Indianapolis. Misogynoir, abetted by dehumanizing caricature, is like water. It fills its vessel, taking many forms, and then it overflows, creeping unnoticed into the cracks of things, rotting the foundation. It spreads a belief in Black women's inherent wrongness. It decays how the government sees us, how employers see us, how the medical system sees us, how our lovers see us, how we see each other and ourselves. I first wrote The Sisters Are All Right out of anger at the warped societal view of Black womanhood. I wrote it because I want Black women to be seen. I want to be seen. I want my three young nieces to know their own humanity and demand other people know it too. I wrote the book because even if the world won't love us, I want Black women to love ourselves and love each other. I write this second edition because the Black femme experience in America continues to bend and evolve. And I am a water witch, divining the places where racism and sexism flow. We need this. Otherwise, Black women's every seeming success will turn fetid. Black women are a million different kinds of amazing. It is not our race or gender that makes this true. It is our humanity. This book is about that humanity, the textured, difficult, and beautiful humanity that lies in the hearts of all Black women because I love us. Now, before you get really tired of my voice, I am just going to read a very short piece of the preface to Dear Black Girl. But I thought it was important for you to hear my view on Black women's experience before I talk to you about our relationship with Black girls. So Dear Black Girl starts, "My Black girls, you tell me things. You tell me how you love your mamas, but kind of hate them too. You tell me about the ugh, fuck boys at school who text dirty messages. You tell me about beauty insecurities, two big noses and five heads. You tell me who you like, showing me pictures of boys on IG and giggling, ain't he cute? You tell me these things and I smile. It has been a while since I was a girl, but I remember hating my parents' rules and being insecure about my looks. I remember the trifling boys and the super fine crushes. Some things about Black girlhood never change. But you tell me other things too. You tell me about anxiety or depression that will not let go. You tell me about social media memes that leave you feeling demeaned and hated. You tell me about boys and men who violate you and families who cannot deal with the devastation of sexual assault. You tell me about carrying the burden of friends and family who have been murdered. You tell me about families who cannot accept your queer identity. You tell me about schools that suspend you for petty reasons. You tell me how people assume you are angry, unfeminine, grown, and hypersexual before you can even find out who you are for yourself. You tell me these things and I worry. I remember that the world does not value Black girls like it should. Some things that are too common in Black girlhood must change."
Well, all right. So with that being said, I guess the only question left to answer, is how do we get here?
How did we get here?
I could sing it for you, but you want them to stay.
Right. So how do we get here, and how did we get to this book? How did we get to Dear Black Girl?
Yeah.
So what, I mean, actually a few things. So part of it was when I was touring around for the Sisters Are All Right, I started to notice that when I was in groups of Black women, and we were talking about, you know, the stereotypes of Black women. So the Sisters Are All Right was about, you know, the core stereotypes of Black women and how they've kind of followed us over centuries and still exist today. And so I'd be in these groups with Black women, and we would be talking. So when we talked about ourselves, you know, we rejected those stereotypes. Absolutely not. I am not hypersexual. I am not Latin, or maybe I am, but it doesn't matter. So we were able to like come to a place where we could reckon with those stereotypes and find our humanity outside of them. But then when conversations would arise about Black girls or younger women, suddenly those same stereotypes started to come back. And I remember the exact moment I was at an event and there was like an elder sister, she was probably in her 70s, and she was speaking about younger Black women, and she was like, stank face. She's like, I don't know, these younger women, they're awfully free with their bodies. They must think it's some kind of liberation. But it just seemed so hateful and unkind. And it seemed like the idea that underpinned her attitude was very much rooted in Jezebel. And so I wondered how younger women and how girls were receiving, like what they were receiving from Black women. And actually, as you know, I came back home and I actually started interviewing Black girls and young Black women. And I did hear from them that, you know, certainly they got all the slings and arrows from, you know, majority culture. They saw all of that. But also, oftentimes, the people who reinforced those things. So it was grandma who said, don't stay in the sun because you'll get too dark. Or it was, you know, a school counselor that was a Black woman that was like, you're too loud, you're too ghetto. So, you know, I began wondering, like, we should be each other's greatest allies, but not if we can't let go of all of these stereotypes, and not just what it means for us, but also what it means for each other, especially younger women. And then you and I, you and I did a workshop here in Indianapolis with Kepper Institute, with our third founder, Dr. Tiffany Dent. And it was with Black women. And we just had this fantastic conversation where women talked about how sometimes fear for, you know, girls and young women, they realize caused them to commit some of the same sins that the broader culture commits against Black women and girls. Because, you know, we know that Black women and girls are judged harshly. We know that Black women and girls don't get a lot of second chances. So when we see a younger woman or girl doing something that we think will bring negative attention to her, we get scared. Mm-hmm. And so it comes out sometimes in ways that don't feel loving. Yeah. So I was like, what if I created a space, this book, and ask Black women to have honest and vulnerable and authentic conversations, not from a place of don't do this, you're wrong, fix yourself, but from a here's what happened to me and here's what I want you to know about your womanhood and your girlhood.
Well, you know, it's always that finger of accusation versus hand of help phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and we've talked about this, that we spend as a people so much time in survival mode, mm-hmm. that we don't know how to operate outside of that. And when you're in survival mode, what are the things that you're looking at? You're looking at basic needs, moving through day to day, and all that extra stuff is just that. Mm-hmm. And it impacts everything, including the way you define what love looks like. And I see this a lot in the schools. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll have a kid come in, and usually, as a disciplinarian, you know, they're never coming to see me for fun things. Mm-hmm. So someone will come in, and every now and again, something will come up that someone with different letters behind their name need to address. I'm like, all right, we need social worker in here, mm-hmm. because this is no longer a discipline issue. Mm-hmm. This is a family therapy issue. And I remember very specifically this one child. He was like, looked his mom dead in the face and said, you don't care about me. Mm-hmm. And the way she reacted to that was very telling about the things that we value in survival mode. She was like, what do you mean? You eat every day. You have a roof over your head. You are clothed. You are fed. How can you say I don't love you? Mm-hmm. And he started to kind of name, you know, those extra things. And she's like, look, You got three hots, a cot, you got shoes, you got clothes. Boy, don't you ever say I don't love you. And so that continuous operating in survival mode changes what love looks like for a lot of people. So I guess my question to you is, after all of that, my question to you is, how do we begin the process of changing what love looks like for Black women who are always put, who are almost always the ones responsible for said survival?
I mean, I've always felt like, and I don't, it doesn't seem like people agree with me that if we want to fix a lot of our, the problems we feel like are intractable, we ought to be focusing on Black women in many spaces, because when we are not supported, and we know that we are the heads of most Black households, we just statistically are, when we're not supported, nobody is supported. Our children are not supported. Our communities are not supported. There are so many of us that are out here being activists and community organizers. And if we're the ones doing that and we're the ones leading households and no one is supporting us, then all of those things are affected.
Yeah. And that's kind of the
unless same. We're okay. If we're
absolutely
okay, nobody is okay.
Because even when we, again, as a champion for Black girls in education, I always get pushback. And that pushback usually looks like, what about the boys? What are we doing for the boys? If you're going to do this for girls, what are we going to do for boys? And my answer to that is usually very similar to what you just said. It's like, we can do all of the mentoring in the world, but at the end of the day, who are these boys going home to? Going home to former Black girls. So at the end of the day, we've got to heal the entire unit. And you can't do that by constantly throwing Black women and girls to the wayside, because we'll be all right.
And that's my worry. I mean, I think we need to work on everybody in the Black community, right? But very often the pathway and the direction people take is to expect Black women and girls to accept sort of a trickle down justice. It's like we will deal with Black men and Black boys, and then when we're finished with that, then we'll work with you. Even in spaces where we are similarly struggling. We're Black girls are the fastest rising group to be incarcerated in juvenile incarceration.
And suspended. That's
and suspensions. So if you don't address things like that and just say, well, we got to work over here, then, I mean, because we may have a crack or more or be able to, you know, perform a little bit better in certain spaces, if we ignore Black women and Black girls, we're not going to fix any problems and we're going to be doomed. But I wonder if you would read your letter in the book, because one of the things that was very important to me is in the book is to talk about various identities. As a matter of fact, that's the first chapter that you hit. So I kind of tried to organize the book so, you know, we can kind of open with some very affirming and uplifting letters, and also end with things we're affirming and uplifting. And in the middle, kind of dig more into some difficult conversations. But in identity, I wanted to talk about everything from skin color and beauty and sexuality and gender identity and, you know, biracialness and all of those intersected issues that Black girls deal with. And I knew I wanted a book about color. I wanted a letter about colorism, and I knew that I wanted Carolyn to write it. She was one of the writers who got told what they were gonna write about. So
I got told digitally. I didn't get a phone call.
No,
it was a text. Write this.
So okay. I wonder if you would share that.
Absolutely. Dear brown-skinned Black girl, if no one else tells you this today, hear it from me. You and your chocolate shell are beautifully and wonderfully made. As a young girl growing up with chocolate skin and 4C hair, the tightest of tight kinks and curls, I didn't see anyone on television that looked like me. And if somehow a girl like me did make it to the screen, she was usually being made fun of. That made me feel like I was not beautiful. And I've spent the last 35 years trying to turn that feeling around. I'm going to do my best right now to tell you the things that I wish someone had told me back then. Read this as often as you need to be okay. They hate you because they ain't you. Look around, love. People who don't have what you have and don't look how you look are paying big bucks to get what the Creator bestowed upon you for free. The next time you see a girl on IG tan to death with lip fillers, butt implants, and box braids, just remember, yours is free and organic. We are slowly, ever so slowly, moving toward a world that sees the beauty in you, in us. As I write this, Miss Universe, Miss America, Miss USA, and Miss Teen USA are all beautiful, vibrant Black women of varying hues and hair textures. They are a visual representation of all the ways that Black girls can be and are physically beautiful. In the meantime, know that the absence of dark-skinned girls in mainstream culture says more about the people making that culture than it says about you. As a girl, I remember thinking, what's wrong with me? I had a ton of answers, and each one made me feel worse than the one before it. I don't want that for you. Bump that. Your melanin, the thing that controls how brown you are, it is an asset. People may give you crap about it, and you may not appreciate it now. But know this, honey. The saying black don't crack is real, and melanin is the best anti-aging cream you could ever ask for. Beautiful Black girl, if you let it, this world will take your soul and try to convince you that you handed it over willingly. It is my job as a fellow Black girl to stop that from happening. I start by telling you that you are beautiful. The Creator makes no mistakes, but also know that in your beauty lies the ability to do and be anything you want. And if nothing else, know that this chocolate girl loves you.
Now, just because I know this story, can you talk a little bit about your relationship? Well, what you learned from your mother raised you, and how you wrestled with the issues of skin color and sort of her feelings and the things she did to kind of save and protect you that.
Oh, you want me to talk about Mommy Dearest? Okay.
Saving and protecting.
Well, my relationship with my mom, as a lot of us, it's complicated. First off, you know, mother is the person that raised you. So I was raised by my great-great-grandmother's sister. So you're talking about somebody who was 70 plus by the time I was born. So we're already mitigating a bunch of generational stuff. And while I will always say that she was very progressive for her time, I will always give her that. There were still some things that were very generational that were hard to get around. And the main one was the colorism piece. And like the folks that couldn't go play out in the sun, that was definitely me. Like, I was summertime shy, because I'm from Chicago. Summertime shy was in the house because you are dark enough already. Bring your butt in from out the sun. We having a hard enough time with your situation over here, because my skin color was indeed a situation, according to my mother. So one of the things that I wrestled with as I got older that I finally figured out was that goes back to what we were saying before about being rooted in fear. And I also realized that it was one of the reasons that she so ardently supported me academically, because in her mind, looking the way I look, being the size that I am, having the skin color that I have, having the hair texture that I have, the only way that I was going to be able to survive was by being smart. So that was always the push for her. You better get those good grades, because look at you. You better make sure that you're in that gifted program, because no man is gonna want you looking like this. And so even in her push for those things, it was still rooted in colorism. And it was her way of trying to give me something, which it's really hard, or it took a long time to unpack. I won't say it was really hard. It took a long time to unpack that at the end of the day, she really genuinely, honestly, and truly thought she was helping me. Like, she really did. And that's why it becomes so hard to wrestle with, because it's like, okay, human nature and human preservation dictate that when someone makes you feel this way, you just kind of cut that cord and leave that be. But then you wrestle with the fact that, but this person is doing this because they love me, and they don't think they're hurting me. They think they're helping me. So it costs a lot of money to figure that out, to figure out exactly what where we were going to end up in this space. And that is why I wanted to write that letter. And that is why a big part of my research focuses on colorism and interracial bullying, because a lot of it is stuff that we do and we don't even understand why. One of the things that I typically do, and this group is small, so I may not find the answer that I'm looking for, but I usually do. In the Black community, when a baby is born, what do we pinch and what do we check when that baby first comes? Does anybody know? Go for it.
Ears.
What do we checking ears, and what are we pinching? Somebody just said it. We pinching the nose. Why are we checking ears? Because the first thing you do when that baby comes out is you look behind those ears, because I need to know what I'm working with. And we're pinching the nose because bones aren't formed yet. So if I pinch your nose a little bit every day, guess what you won't end up with? A big, wide, Africanized nose. I've never met most of you before, but at least two people in this room knew what I was talking about, because these are things that have been passed down for no real reason other than the fact that it's what we've always done.
Well, so here's the question, though, and I ask you this as an educator, but also as a mom of two girls. What is the right way? Because there's a we know that the world outside doesn't necessarily value dark brown skin, don't value figures features that are viewed as being Africanized, so wide noses and, you know, starting to like fuller lips now, but that's new.
Only if they're fake.
Right. Not the real ones.
Not the real.
Kinky hair. All we know that society doesn't value those things. And so what does it look like? Now, your mother felt like she was arming you for the world you were going to enter into by telling you all of those things and by viewing you in that way. What is the better way and the healthier way to do that?
And that goes back to what we were saying before. What is the way to do it when you're not operating in survival mode? Mm-hmm. Because that's what all of this really boils down to. And what I have attempted to do as a mom is to arm my children with a big enough village and enough love for themselves so that what's coming in from outside doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And that's always been how I've operated. Now, granted, my children are not as dark as I am, the running joke has been, and you know this, I have two master's degrees, a doctorate, and my mother probably would say my greatest accomplishment was having two light-skinned babies. So, one of the things that I always tell people is you've got to pour into your children. And when you're pouring into them, you need to be mindful of what you're saying as well as what you're not saying. You need to take into account what you're doing as well as what you're not doing, because what you don't say and what you don't do sends its own message. Mm-hmm. And I had an acquaintance back in the day, twins looked very different. One was dark with tighter hair, one was not. And the one with the tighter hair would always have to, you know, spend the hours in the chair getting to wash the press, the beads and everything. And the other one, you just washing her and letting her go. And when they got older, she really couldn't understand why the darker one had a complex. She's like, I never made a difference in them. I never said anything. And she didn't. But you taught her without meaning to, that she has to put all of this extra work in herself just to exist. And your other daughter does not. And so that's what I mean about being mindful of the things that you're not saying and not doing, as well as the things that you do. Because these little kids, especially these newfangled pandemic children, they pick up on everything. And like my 7-year-old said something to me the other day about noticing when I'm happy versus when I'm not. And asking why I seem happier when I'm doing this thing versus when I'm doing that thing, which tells you just how much they watch and take in. And they're not just watching and replicating, they're watching and processing and formulating their own ideas and opinions about these things. So you've got to constantly, constantly pour into them to let them know that they are enough. Because if it doesn't come from us, it's damn sure not coming from anywhere else.
And that's, you know, that's one of the things that I wanted to do with the book. So the, you know, there are other, in the identity chapter, there are people who talk about, you know, being trans, being biracial, being like the range of different identities. Because one of the things that I notice, and experiences, because one of the things that I notice very often about books that were geared towards Black girls is we wrote about and to Black girls as we wish they were, as opposed to how they actually are. And the how we wish they were is usually all tied up in respectability, at which, you know, people know respectability politics is the idea that in order that we sort of have to earn and prove our equalness, our equality. And that means by, you know, living up to standards and values that are associated with whiteness and middle classness and straightness and Christianness and all of those things. But the reality is there are Black girls who have completely different experiences. And I wanted them to know that those experiences were valid. So I wanted a variety of Black women to write about those lived experiences. One of the chapters is actually my favorite chapter in the book is about family. And I thought that was important because very often Black families are denigrated from the ways that they are different from the perfect American family, which really never existed and for damn sure doesn't exist now for anybody.
And culturally for us is counterintuitive to what our DNA suggests we should be doing. But I digress.
So I wanted to make sure that I had a lot of letters from women who had a variety of families, because anybody that has a group of people that hold you and hold you down, that's a family. So I wanted to hear from, you know, Black women with made families, Black women who were raised by grandparents, Black women who were adopted. I wanted Black women to write about their mothers. This is a letter I'm about to share by Hannah Echo, who's a fabulous writer, so you should look her up. I thought was interesting because she was actually raised briefly fostered. She's a African-American woman who was raised partially by a white family. And she wrote, "Dear little Black girls I once saw in a South Dakota watering hole. We were the only Black people at Evans Plunge Mineral Springs. You were two pretty dark-skinned girls splashing around the coldish water. You were tucked within a large white family, and I was with my white boyfriend driving cross country between Portland and New York. After about an hour or so, our trio were the only ones standing within the echoing shower of the ladies' locker room. The droplets hit the ground like random applause, and you gazed at me with wide, cavernous eyes, neon bathing suits stark against the darkness of the room. I smiled because I did not know what to say. Almost 8 years later, and my mind still flutters toward you. You are close to 12 now. Dear not so little black girls I once saw in a South Dakota watering hole, we are a different 12. There are online forums for transracial adoptees. Four black women were crowned the most beautiful in their universes just last year. There is a black Little Mermaid. Maybe your parents learned to Bantu knot via a YouTube tutorial. Maybe they know color blindness is not an attribute. Maybe they take focused care to gently lead you through this thing called life, proud of being a black girl. We are the same 12. A 12 teeming with questions unasked because life is odd and dynamic. Like, why are white girls driven to make your life a passive aggressive hell? Why were you given up anyways? Why do some black girls make fun of the way you talk? How can you be proud of yourself and admit that sometimes everything is confusing? I was once a black girl fostered by white people, a young black woman in schools that were mostly white. When I brought up instances of racism or sexism, I was told I was too sensitive, crazy, and/or my favorite, a class A racist myself. Sometimes the worst hurt was the ones I received from those who looked like me. I learned to bottle the storm, look at it, lock it in within my shoulders and stomach. Pretend. Still, I am here, loving this self, liking her more days than not. Dear, now not so little black girls I once saw in a South Dakota watering hole. There's a concept in yoga called ahimsa, which is a respect towards all living things and a practice of non-harm. Most people usually think of this topic as it relates to other human beings and animals, but when it comes to black girls adopted or living in white spaces, the work of ahimsa is just as powerful when applied to the self. We who too often learn to harm ourselves in ways the world will not recognize or care about. We who learn to suffer silently because there are bigger concerns. I smiled at you that day, my mouth wordless. What I had wanted to say was, please do not hurt yourself. Adore your skin, hair, your mouth, your heart, and your mind. Never try controlling another human being. Accept the history of who you are and how you came to be. Practice love and respect. The white girls who perform quiet meanness and the black girls who tease you are dealing with a pain that is not yours to carry. Do not try. Dear not so little black girls I once saw in a South Dakota watering hole, you will mess up. I chose white dolls over black ones, lived in an era where I thought white things were smarter, deeper, better. I quieted the essence of who I truly was around black people, belittled my experience for the difference it held. Ahimsa is a practice, a chain, a string of beads linking to infinity. And life is life. In that shower 8 years ago, you stared like I was the first black person you had witnessed in a long time. We regarded each other in the rush of water and steam, our flip-flops squishing bubbles. If your eyes were silent x-rays at the center of my chest, would have been a prayer for you that had yet to be made into words. Dear not so little black girls I once saw in a South Dakota watering hole, may you love yourself exactly as you are and have the courage to always try. Love, Hannah.
Wow.
Well, I have a question, because that just sparked something. That is a very unique experience. It's an experience that not a lot of us have. So with that being said, why was it so important to you to, when you're already talking about an overlooked population, mm-hmm. why was it so important to you to include the overlooked within the overlooked?
Well, because we contain multitudes, there is no one Black girl experience. And so, you know, like I said, so much that is directed at Black girls and women want to narrow us into one way of being a woman and one way of being a Black woman and one way to live. And I think that's unfair. We deserve to live expansive lives. And even though, you know, Hannah's experience is a different one, there aren't a lot of Black women that are necessarily raised or fostered by white people. There are definitely some. There are definitely many. And there are many of us. I mean, I read that and I identified it not as someone who was raised by a white family, but who has been the only in many, many experiences, both as a child. You know, when I first started going to elementary school, if you look at my first grade picture, I'm one of like two or three Black kids, and that's in Gary, Indiana. So, you know, I've had that experience going to Iowa State University, which is where I went to college. Like many of us, we have all, it's hard to escape being the only at some point in your life. And so even if you didn't grow up like Hannah, I know that, you know, Black women and girls who are reading the book have certainly felt an aspect of what Hannah writes about feeling.
Makes sense. You gonna read another letter?
So I will, you know, one of the other things that I thought was important to talk about was difficult, tough thing. There's a chapter called Tough Stuff. I think that's what I called it.
Yeah, I think so too.
More. But again, I wanted to get at that idea that very often when we talk to Black girls, we want to ignore the things that actually legitimately happened to them.
I think that's, I didn't ask for this.
I didn't ask for this. Yeah, that's a lot more creative than what I first said. So, you know, we know some things about Black girls' lives. We know, like we said, we know about rates of incarceration and suspension. We know that sometimes Black girls get pregnant before they come of age. We know that 60% of Black girls will experience sexual assault before they turn 18. But we don't talk about it, again, because it doesn't fit into notions of respectability. And I thought it was very important, again, to have Black women talk about all of those experiences so that Black girls know that they are not alone. And there are Black women who have lived through them and come out on the other side. So I wanted to share a letter, but I also want to give a trigger warning because it's a letter about sexual assault. And so I wanted to make sure you knew that, so if it doesn't feel comfortable for someone, you have that warning.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want to take a minute, if anybody wants to step away for a second, please feel free.
Please feel free to do so.
Okay.
Dear Black girl, I hope this letter finds you well. I'd be lying if I said I haven't been struggling with writing it for the last several days. Even now, as a Gen Xer in her early 40s with a husband and a child and a life of her own, the ghosts of assaults past stay with me. 2 years ago this month, I was sexually assaulted by an acquaintance who offered me a ride home, my ex-boyfriend's cousin. Even at my big age, I pointed the finger at myself for not knowing better. Despite all evidence, despite knowing that the only way to prevent a rape is by not being a rapist, I still chastised myself for not doing enough to protect myself. If you're of a certain age, chances are you've already experienced someone taking liberties with your body without consent. It might have been as benign as a male classmate popping your bra strap or smacking you on the behind. And chances are, if you responded with anger, you were told to chill because you were overreacting. That's how the seeds are sown. We're taught to shoulder the responsibility of shielding ourselves from harm, and that if someone hurts us, we must examine our actions to figure out why. Was it something I wore? Was it something I said? which of course is bullshit. 60% of Black girls living in this country have experienced sexual assault before the age of 18. It's not you, sis. It's the world around you. A world that tells people that it's okay to touch you without permission because your skirt was too short, or you drank too much, or you were too free. It's patriarchal smoke and mirrors, a nasty parlor trick meant to devalue you. Please don't fall for it. You deserve better than this world you're inheriting, and I'm sorry we couldn't fix it before you had to face this reality. Bad news is that I have no easy answers. The good news is that I'm here to give you all the permission you might ever need to not feel ashamed, to not accept any attempts to blame you, to tell the people who try to sell you this lie of culpability in your assault where they can go and how they can get there. Anyway, if this has happened to you, I want to tell you right here, right now, this is not your fault. It is never your fault. And that anger, it's valid. Never feel bad for exercising autonomy over your body. Never. Never apologize for standing your ground, for saying no, for fighting back. You are your strongest advocate and your fiercest champion. There is nothing to be ashamed of. Nothing about you has been dirtied or ruined or whatever other lies might be shoved your way. You survived, and that's enough. No one gets to judge you or disrespect you or disregard your pain or your rage. If this has happened to you, do not hide in shame. Do not be afraid to share your story. Stories are important. They are the thread that connects us. They tell us that we are not alone. Just as you may find solace in these words, someone else might find solace in yours. With love, Jamie. So I wonder, I always love to end with an epilogue. The epilogue to Dear Black Girl was my letter. I didn't write a letter, but the epilogue was my letter. And I always like to end with it because I like to end with like positive affirmation for Black women and girls. And I thought I might end this discussion with that, and maybe we can talk about as a group, one, your thoughts on what Carolyn and I have been discussing, but also about how we, I just love since there's this exhibit that is, you know, crafted around the idea of wombs, like how we, like I've been stuck thinking about over the last few months is how Black women and Black girls, how do we birth our authentic selves? Like, how do we disentangle ourselves from all of those stereotypes and all of that historic baggage to be okay? And I'd love to have that conversation. That means you all are going to have to talk.
It does.
But first, I'd like to share the epilogue because it's sort of my love letter to Black women and girls. And it's titled Pick Up Your Oyster Knife. And I hope you guys get the reference. I love you, Black girl. I love Black girls in Afro puffs and Black girls in bundles of Remy. I love the daddy's girls and the fatherless ones. I love the little sisters who make straight A's and the ones who skip school. I love the hood girls and the suburban girls and the country girls too. I love the quiet girls and the loud girls, the lip smacking, smart talking ones. I love the saved girls and the heathens. I love the girls who stay in sweatshirts and J's and the ones in tight Fashion Nova fits. I love the happy girls and the anxious girls and the girls battling depression. I love the trans girls living defiantly. I love the girls in the library and the ones on the basketball court. I love the virgins and the young mamas. I love the girly girls and the butch girls. I love the girls who fight. I love the girls who love boys and the girls who love girls and the girls who love both or neither. I love you, Black girl unconditionally, and whether you are 15 or 50. You hear me today. I love you whether you look or act like they say you should. You are not wrong. And when you are wrong, I love you with all your flaws. No matter what choices and mistakes you have made, no matter where you live, no matter what you look like, no matter what thing has happened to you. And the greatest thing you can learn is to love yourself unconditionally too. It may be the hardest thing you have to learn. I hope the letters in this book have shown you how. One other thing, Black girl, you must learn to love other Black women and girls the same way. Love us whether we look or act like they say we should. We are not wrong, and when we are wrong, love us with all our flaws. No matter what choices and mistakes we have made, no matter where we live, no matter what we look like, no matter what thing has happened to us. This doesn't mean you have to become target for another Black girl's pain or anger or trauma. Doesn't mean you have to silence yourself in the face of Black women. It means you must give your sisters grace and understanding, the benefit of the doubt. So few people give us that, and we owe it to each other. We have to acknowledge each other's humanity, even maybe especially when we are walking away. I hope the letters in this book have shown you how to do that too. Because we are sisters, Black girl, we have to take care of ourselves and each other. You are me, I am you, and we are all right. Inside each of us are tiny pieces of our foremothers. Sarah Boone's ingenuity, Danielle Luna's unforgettable beauty, Toni Morrison's incomparable wisdom, Mamie Till's fierce love, Aretha Franklin's creativity, Marsha P. Johnson's fearlessness, Harriet Tubman's will to survive, Katherine Johnson's genius, Michelle Obama's grace. Black girls are made up of all that magic, birthed in the African sun, baptized by the Middle Passage, and burnished by America. That is a power that no one else can claim, just us. We are sisters. You are me. I am you. And we will get free together. Zora Neale Hurston, a great Black woman writer, once said, "I do not weep at the world. I am too busy sharpening my oyster knife." An oyster knife is a utensil used to crack open the shell of an oyster to get the tasty meat inside. Zora meant that she wasn't wasting time thinking about the hard parts of being Black and a woman. She didn't care about what other people said about her, and she was busy trying to get all the good stuff that life had to offer. So celebrate your Black girl life, celebrate us, be like Zora, and get that oyster, girl.